In the studio with me right now is Robert Colangelo from Green Sense Farms, Green Sense Radio. Mm-hmm. How do you like the new digs?
Mike, this is unbelievable. When I was on WCPT, it didn't look anything like this. You must be so happy.
Well, it's actually closer to me as well. We were down on the south side, South Pulaski. And I love the south side. I love the south siders. The problem was it was just so hard to get to. Here, it's like boom-bitty-boom. What is it? Ron Cowgill says, boom, done. And, it's state of the art. And, so you get a chance to see this. Now, Robert had a show here, for a short time called Green Sense Radio, but Green Sense Radio still goes on. You're on WBBM. You do minutes on, like a green minute on WBBM, but you also do the long form show, which is half an hour.
Yes, we're on about 10 stations, not quite coast to coast. We're on the East Coast, West Coast, and the Midwest. But I really want to thank you for having me on your show. And I commend you for doing what you do and energizing the public about sustainability and talking about the environment. There's not enough of us out there, so congratulations on being on the air so long.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. It's, as you know, because you've done this, and we've had conversations about this, radio ain't easy. Okay. And, you're always looking for somebody to help keep you on the air. In my case, I need my advertisers. So I tell people to support my wonderful advertisers and go frequent them and buy their products. And when you do, say you heard it on Mike's show and, I don't know if you do that exactly the same way, but, they do that on radio and it's important. This is how we keep this going. And my congratulations to you too, also for the same work you do. We're in similar realms. You talk about gardening too on your show, don't you?
Not so much. We cover a much broader base of issues around sustainability, energy, transportation, water, the built environment, agriculture, urban farming. Mm-hmm. It's a much broader base.
And I try to bring it back home to the one-on-one with the people out there who are planting seeds in their yards, like you heard Vicky Nowicki here earlier with, and the idea of a lending. Seed lending library is just very cool, and now we're going to get to what you're doing, but I want to introduce you to Rick DeMaio, my meteorologist. You might remember Rick. He's been on television all over the area.
Sure. Hi, Rick.
Yeah, good morning, Robert. How are you? Nice to hear you, and congratulations on your success as well. I know you and Mike are one of few, but sometimes one of few have many ears, and I think the more people know about you, the more people will listen, and the more people will become educated. So as you congratulated Mike, I congratulate you as well, Robert.
Well, thank you so much, Rick, and I've heard you both on TV and on radio, and sustainability, climate change is something we cover a lot, and I'm sure that's a hot area for you these days.
Yeah, and it is, and even at Loyola University, where they have actually taken their science program and has made it more of an institute of environmental sustainability. One of the things that are being done there is they're actually transferring over the three weather and climate classes that they require the environmental studies students to take. I know you received your BS and your MS from Northeastern Illinois University in that field. One of the things that they're doing is they're actually changing the course to reflect more climate change and climate variability and not just teaching weather and climate. I think that's what a lot of other schools need to do as well as incorporating, things like GIS, geographical information systems, which is a newer, more advanced way of looking at data. And what that does is it really begins to expand the students' mindset from outside of Chicago, outside of Illinois, outside the Midwest, outside the United States, outside North America, and through other parts of the world, because we've become so global, you need to change the way that you teach and you need to change the way that you educate. So I think the way that kids are learning today is even different from how you learned it and how I learned it. And it's exciting to be, kind of on the forefront of that.
One of the favorite guests on my show was James Balog. He created the documentary Chasing Ice, where mm-hmm. he put time-lapse cameras in five continents, and he filmed the glaciers over a couple of years. And it was just amazing to see how these glaciers almost deflated like balloons and shrank over the two-year period. And one of his comments was that we have to stop believing in things. We have to be using data and science to make our opinion. So when you look at what you're talking about, of taking a holistic approach, I think it'll make people much more educated on how to react to climate change and global warming.
Oh, no doubt. You know, it's funny. I was listening. Yesterday I was at an event, and the sustainability director for Harper College was there. And Illinois Solar is going to be hosting an event there on Tuesday. And what's so fascinating is that they are working very hard to bring sustainability into every subject. So it's not just the environmental scientists, but it's the English, it's the math, it's the science, it's every single subject is talking about this.
And just like the U.S. Green Building Council coming out with the LEED standard, if we all do our job, we'll be out of a job, because green should be normalized into society, and that should just be the way we do things.
That's like Julie Rizzo from Recycle Granite came on my show and said, I'm trying to put myself out of work. Mm-hmm. You know, if we she recycles the granite because it's such a waste that they throw all the millions of pounds of scrap granite into landfills. And she said, I'd really prefer they didn't use it for countertops because it's just too wasteful. And there's a lot of energy expended in using that. But at least she's finding a way to mitigate that expenditure of energy.
And what I like about that is that there's a mindfulness about it. So it's like, okay, I'm thinking about what I'm doing and what are the implications of it? What is my waste stream? You know, do I really need this? Because what's happening downstream from it? So
Julie was just out at the farm. She's a good friend.
And, is she? I didn't know that. Because she's from Indiana, too. Yeah.
We're going to use some of her recycled granite. But again, like USGBC, you see the LEED standard being assimilated into a lot of building codes. And so people are just building buildings better. And I see sustainability creeping into every facet of society. But they're going to need us to report on where the new technologies are. Mm-hmm. The world's changing.
Wait. So I actually have a purpose? This is a great thing. Well, let's get back to Rick here, though, because, Rick, you started to talk about you were at the severe weather seminar.
At Fermilab yesterday, yep.
At Fermilab, and they were not afraid to look at the bigger picture, and that's kind of where Robert comes in, because he's keeping the bigger picture in mind. I mean, he's growing food indoors, and if you're growing food indoors, you kind of take weather out of the equation.
You do.
But still, that's not everything's not going to be grown indoors. This, you know, ultimately. So I'm kind of curious about what they were saying at Fermilab about some of these patterns. That you, one thing that struck me, what you said last hour, is that we're getting into patterns that lock in and don't go away. How is that going to affect us?
Well, I think one of the things that we've begun to look at on the larger scale of weather is taking climate and making more or less impact type of predictions, as opposed to just saying cooler than normal or wetter than normal, but making those predictions kind of lassoed onto the current weather trend and saying that what the upcoming spring will be more of an impact on what has been occurring. So in other words, if we can look at, say, the upcoming spring and summer season for the desert Southwest in California, and this has already actually been done in the past, but they're getting a little bit more involved in actually having specific impact statements, whereas I think before it was basically climate scientists talking to climate scientists, and the National Weather Service is really more or less a function of people producing weather products, but not really climate per se products. That was always done from the different agency, but now I think some of those products are now being put into some of the daily and weekly forecasts so that we know more about what a wet spring will do following, say, a very late season cold pattern. You know, what that'll do to agriculture, what that'll do to trees, what that'll do to newly planted shrubs and things like that. And I think that's where they're beginning to go with it. And part of this, Mike and Rob, you probably know about this as well. If you look at the number of billion-dollar weather disasters over the United States, just in the last 5 years, we're close to $500 billion. Half a trillion. If you go back to 2000, we're over a trillion. You can actually go from 2000 all the way to 1900. We don't have anything close to that. So I always like to think about this as car insurance, okay? If you have a more expensive car and you're driving in a lot more in an area that has a lot more accidents, you need more insurance. So what we need to do here, part of the mitigation effort, is to have more insurance, knowing that these long-term climate changes, which will become more impactful, will in the end cost us more money. And that's where sustainability and mitigation kind of become hand in hand. It's basically having insurance for the future based on the probability that something bad will happen.
Couldn't have said it better.
We also have to be much smarter with our water and land use. When you see the drought condition in California, it's endemic. It's not just a one-time event. Just my research and talking with people on the show, we're finding that the wetter places are getting wetter, the drier places are getting drier, and water seems to be moving away from the equator to the poles. So we have to be much smarter where we farm. You don't want to be using nut and fruit trees that take hundreds of gallons of water a day per tree in drought climates. And, you know, we're depleting aquifers like the Ogallala. It's a huge aquifer, but you're seeing the fringes of that at a point where we can't pump it anymore.
Well, and unfortunately, we're fracking in those areas, too. And we're draining good water that should be used for civilization instead so that we can go get cheap natural gas.
So what I've seen is that farming hasn't changed very much in the last couple hundred years. And so we're going to get much smarter about how we farm.
Well, it has changed in one and I know you're there, Rick, and I want to just note on that. It has changed in one significant way, and that is our inputs. We've gone to synthetic chemicals.
Right.
And that changed the equation completely. And now we're beginning to realize we haven't been paying as much attention to the biology of our soil as, you know, at one point we thought, oh, we just throw NPK at everything and that's going to solve all of our problems. And now we're realizing, well, wait a second, what about the biology? And as I'd like to say, it's the biology, stupid. Rick, you were going to add?
Yeah, you know what? Actually, you know, one of the reasons why we didn't have as much of an agricultural disaster with the 2012 drought was because of the drought-resistant corn and some of the bioengineering that we've done with that. And I think that's a huge improvement, even though we haven't maybe changed certain farm practices. What we put into the soil has actually got a lot better. And one of the things that I think, universities like Loyola with their Institute of Environment Sustainability is teaching students more about soil erosion and soil degradation in areas of like Central Africa, Central South America, where you have people who literally live year by year by year saying, okay, if this soil isn't going to work for me, I'm moving someplace else. Look at what we did back in the 1930s, the greatest ecological disaster in the United States. Was in the Great Plains and the Dust Bowl, all built on greed, all built on, well, if it rains, those three words, if it rains, we will have food. If it rains, we will get out of the drought. If it rains, we will no longer have dust. Well, it didn't rain for 6 years. Okay. Now we've actually changed the type of soil that we have and the type of seed to get through some of these droughts and some of these heat waves. But it doesn't mean that it's going to get any better. It'll still happen. We just have to be a little bit more aware of it.
Yeah, you're interesting, and it points to sometimes we don't act in our own self-interest. I was watching Ken Burns' wonderful documentary on the Dust Bowl. If you haven't seen it, you need to see it.
Right.
And what he points out is that when conditions were good, they planted more corn.
More wheat, more corn,
more of everything because the conditions were good. When the conditions were bad, they planted more because they needed to make up for the fact that the conditions weren't good.
So
no matter what the conditions were, they were planting more and more. And eventually when the rain stopped, it stripped all of the soil. And then we had to somehow put it back. And we did. That's the other thing. We figured it out.
But, Mike, who eventually forced the farmers to change their practices?
The meteorologists?
No, it was the government. The government finally stepping in and saying, look, guys, you're not doing this right. So when I hear people say the government should stay out of our lives in certain situations like this, no, because oftentimes people will not make decisions based on the best practices. They'll basically make it on greed, as you just mentioned. And I need to do this. I don't care. Stay out of my backyard. But oftentimes we need people who are smart, we need people who are intelligent, and we need people who have a purpose of just understanding the science. And that's probably the best way to think about it, and not making it become a political statement or you're right and you're wrong because you think that doing this is going to take away jobs. I don't even know why those conversations ever got started. Do you know, do you know that they are about 2 months away from not being able to provide Las Vegas and Phoenix, Arizona with enough drinking water because the intake valves in the Hoover Dam that connected to Lake Mead are getting dangerously low? They may actually have to, over the next 4 to 6 months, lower the intake valves to have water given to those cities. Can you imagine if all of a sudden you're in Phoenix or in Las Vegas and you have no drinking water? Then people begin to realize how serious the situation has become in certain situations. Not everywhere.
If they stop watering the golf courses in Vegas, I'm serious.
And the huge fountains. Right?
And the fountains and using potable water, which is obscene. It's obscene.
Swimming pools.
Yeah. And they're going to find out when the water goes dry that the paradigm is going to have to shift.
Right. The first person who develops powdered water is going to be a genius, right?
Except we won't have anything to mix it with.
I didn't have it here, the drum roll. But
as a recovering hydrogeologist, water's still my passion, and it's always been the belief that we don't have a water shortage problem, we have a water management problem. You've just illustrated that with some of the bad uses of water. And we're going to get much smarter.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, Robert. At Northeastern Illinois University, where they have an environmental science program, are they becoming more aware of changing their curriculum and going more towards sustainability, or is it still done the same way? Have you had any input on that or knowledge of that?
I'm not sure. I haven't been involved with the university for about 20 years, so I'm not sure how the curriculum has changed. And when I started, hydrogeology was somewhat of a new field. And I worked a lot. One of the things that I did was augment my education with hands-on experience. Working at the Field Museum, working at Argonne National Labs, allowed me to really do a lot of different research projects. So I'm not sure what the university's doing.
I think that's one of the best things in the world is being an organization or a university or some sort of a department or a research center that has to change based on the times, because that makes it more interesting and also more challenging.
Well, I was just out at University of Arizona with Dr. Giacomelli, who runs the Controlled Environmental Agriculture Center in Tucson. And they are out in a desert area growing crops using indoor technology. And he's really one of the leaders in the U.S.
Using indoor technology.
He's got a grant from NASA. They're working on the indoor food chamber for the Mars mission. They're doing all sorts of research.
Send me, please. I would like to go.
Fascinating when I was out there. I said, you got to pinch yourself. I mean, you're working on technology that's going to keep people alive out in space. And, we're at a point right now that we can create Groundhog Day inside a facility. The climate is the same every day when you control indoor agriculture. And it's so fascinating and exciting because we're right on the forefront of a new way to grow.
And that's that's the segue. Rick, I'm going to let you go so that I can talk to Robert about his operation.
Good.
Always a pleasure. And thank you for your insight, your additional insight this week.
No problem. Just put more money in the offering basket next time I come around.
Rick, nice talking to you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, Rick.
Bye. It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. That was Rick DeMaio, our meteorologist, stuck around for a little extra. I wanted to introduce him to Robert Colangelo, who is with Green Sense Radio and also Green Sense Farms.
I study nuclear science. I love my classes. I got a crazy teacher. He wears dark glasses. Things are going great.
And they're only getting better.
I'm doing all right. Getting good grades. The future's so bright.
Oh, yeah.
I gotta wear shades.
You know, that's the antithesis song to what we were talking about last week. just keep playing this music. Just keep playing this music and everything will be better, right? And Robert Colangelo is in the studio, too. It's an honor to have you here. I'm so glad that you came by. He's with Green Sense Farms. And as we said, this is the future of some kind of farming. It's not going to replace all outdoor farming, but you're doing it indoors. I've seen the operation. It's vertical farming, meaning that you've got trays stacked to the ceiling with stuff that you're growing, with seeds and seedlings. You're using artificial lights. You're using nutrients that you prepare and feed in there in specific quantities. I mean, it's all, as you said earlier, the weather don't enter into it because there you are in an indoor situation, and it sounds like it's going great.
Our future's so bright. We got to wear shades.
You got to wear shades.
Also, because the LED lights are purple and red, and it makes it look green, so the shades help see clearly, right? As so, you know, when you walked out of there.
Well, and I will say something, and you say what you can say, but it's proprietary technology that you're using, you're employing right now.
We developed this all on our own. We started out with building a grow room. It's roughly 25 feet tall by 60 feet by 60 feet. In there, we have 7 grow towers. We have 2 grow rooms, and we can control the climate in each grow room. One is kept cooler and drier, less humid, so we can grow lettuces. The other grow room is a little hotter and a little bit more humid so that we can grow leafy greens and herbs. And in the grow room, we control everything. As I said, it's Groundhog Day. You walk in today, or you walk in when it's 40 below zero outside, and it's always 70-degree temperature, about 65% humidity. And we control the lights, we control the water, we control the nutrients, and we reduce, reuse, and recycle everything.
It's just, it's unbelievable.
So right now, I think we can grow leafy greens, lettuces, and herbs very well. Over time, we'll be able to possibly grow some fruits and other vegetables, tomatoes, strawberries. And
tomatoes seems like that would be a little more problematic because the way you've got it set up now, the leafy greens, they're very compact, most of them. It's easy to control. Tomato sprawls a little more. I mean, you're obviously investigating how to work that out.
Well, we're working very closely with Purdue and, again, Dr. Giacomelli at the Controlled Environmental Ag Center. And Dr. Kerry Mitchell down at Purdue has got a way to use LED lights where you stack them vertical instead of horizontal. So you get the lights directing on the tomato canopy down low as well as on the top.
So if the tomato is producing throughout the whole plant, not just at the terminus there, you know, the terminal buds, you know.
So I think you're going to see more and more advancements. Our head grower, Lane Patterson, who worked down at the South Pole, where growing indoors was the only way you were going to get fresh vegetables, he grew about 14 different varieties of fruits and plants and vegetables. Uh-huh. So we know that you can do that. He did it on a very small scale. The trick is being able to do it on a commercial scale. And that's where
where you're going, coming in. You're attempting to do this commercially.
Yes.
And because you get, there's a, the warehouse is huge, but at some point, you've got two grow chambers in there. If you wanted more, would you have to go to another warehouse?
We have room to expand within our facility. But our goal is to be the largest commercial farm. We're well located, close to highway access. We can serve a 5-state area and still be considered locally grown. We have the capacity to produce about 1.5 million pounds, about 3 million plants a year. And it is really set up for a production capacity. I think urban farming is a little bit of a misnomer. You can do it on a research basis. You could do it on a nonprofit basis. You could do it on a hobby basis. But to do it commercially inside an inner city, your inputs are way too expensive. Land costs too much. It's hard to transport your inputs in, and it's hard to get your outputs out on a volume basis. We're set up to produce truckloads of produce on a weekly basis. It's hard to do that on a urban farm.
You're talking about outdoor urban farm. What about an indoor urban farm?
Indoor urban farm, it comes down to dollars per square foot. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find space in an inner city where you're leasing it at a rate that you can do farming.
Well, you can't say that it's not worthwhile at all to do urban farming. It's got to have some purpose. But you're saying in terms of scale, it just can't match.
I'm saying doing it on a commercial basis where you're doing large volumes. Mm-hmm. As I said, you could do it on a research basis. You could do it on a hobby basis. You can do it on a nonprofit basis where you're serving a small community. But to try to ramp it up where you're doing it on a large-scale commercial production, even our facility's small. We need to...
That's what I was thinking. As much as you're going to produce and are producing already, because you haven't planted everything yet in the building.
No.
But I would think you could have a whole park full of buildings like that producing food. And that is the ultimate in local food. As you say, you're based in Portage, Indiana, and the advantage of being there is the, you know, Indiana, what's the they say on the tollway, the crossroads of Mid-America.
Of America, yeah. The heartland. We could service 20 million people in the Chicago metro market. This is a very large, one of the second or third largest metropolitan markets in the country. So by just increasing our capacity, we can serve a large area and don't have to travel very many food miles to get that from our farm to people's plate. And that's the real advantage. We have two advantages. One, we go up. That's really the revolutionary or paradigm-changing process here. Instead of farming horizontally, we've taken it up so we can get 10 times the yield as a traditional farm. And then we get 17 to 26 harvests per year. We're harvesting every other week on some crops, where a farmer is only harvesting once, two, or three times a year. So not only do we have a higher density, but we're getting much more turnaround. So we have so much more productivity. But even at that high productivity, our farm at full capacity is about 1,000 cases a week. That's still a drop in the bucket. Someone like a Costco takes 2,500 cases a week. So So our plans are to really ramp up production on a continual basis as we get our crop mix to the customer needs.
Now, is this vertical as well?
Yeah, that's the whole point.
Vertical.
It's all
their
stack.
All of it is vertical.
Yeah, okay. It's all
so
vertical.
So couldn't you – okay, so I know you said that real estate is one of the factors, so square footage. What about all the closed Chicago school buildings? Couldn't we use like those to grow food for the Chicago public school system?
I think that all sounds great in concept, but at the end of the day, just being in the environmental field my whole career, you know, not all green is good. It all starts out, it has to make economic sense before it makes environmental, and it has to make common sense. My past profession was dealing with brownfields, taking contaminated properties and redeveloping those. So I've looked at a lot of buildings that are functionally obsolete or contaminated, and the problem comes is they typically don't have the right ceiling heights. Mm. We need large open space with high ceiling heights, and you have to have good access to the expressways to do this on a volume basis. So you might end up looking at thousands of buildings to find that one building that works. So the answer is yes, there's probably one or two out there. But the site selection process may be voluminous. It took us 2 years to find this building that had the right access to the expressway, it had the right functionality, and it was at the right price.
So do you think it would be better than to start from scratch and find the location and build?
Yes, and that's our phase two. We want to be as energy independent as possible. Our next phase is to have a geothermal heat pump and solar panels.
So it's going to be one of my other questions. Yeah. With those LED lighting, are you putting solar to work so you're at least putting the sun to work in some fashion in growing this food?
That's phase two. When we build our own building, we have a much better way to build this and engineer it so that we're energy independent. And it puts us in a much more sustainable position.
When does that happen?
Soon.
Depends on how
we're in expansion plans. We're doing a private offering to raise additional capital. And there's just been a lot of interest in what we're doing. We officially opened April 1st. We're already ahead of capacity on our orders. And we've got lots of calls from investors these days. And so we're just sorting through all that. As I said, our future's bright.
It is.
Wear those shades.
That's Robert Colangelo from Green Sense Farms. When you approach your buyers, is it a hard sell?
No. What we have seen out
and
there,
what I meant, a difficult sell, not you putting the hard sell on them. I'm saying, is it easy to sell them on the concept.
So we've gone after the top of the food pyramid. If you look at all the produce that's sold, at the top of the pyramid, there's a group of educated consumers that appreciate chemical-free, pesticide-free, non-GMO, organically grown produce, like Whole Foods. We specifically put our facility within 30 minutes of the Whole Food Distribution Center that serves an 8-state area, and we sell directly to them. We sell to other outlets that deal with organic and locally grown foods. We deal with restaurants that appreciate fresh, locally grown food. Where are you going to get locally grown produce in February in the Chicagoland market? So what we found was the first trend was organic. The second trend was locally grown. Now it's year-round availability.
Mm-hmm.
There's very few people that can provide produce. So I don't look as if we have any competitors out there. We're all in this together to try to figure out how to achieve those three goals: locally grown, organic, and year-round.
Speaking of competitors, is anybody doing it on this kind of scale?
People are out there doing it, but not at the scale we're doing it and not at the capitalization and the technology that we're employing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we see working with these universities to constantly develop new technologies so that we're constantly pushing the edge here, growing a wider variety of product and being more sustainable is really the future.
Do you see bringing in students, say, from Purdue to look at the operation, take it back to the campus and develop more and work on this?
Our innovation partner is Philips, the electronics company out of the Netherlands, and we have research projects on the schedule to come up with different light recipes for different crops so that we're developing LED lights that are specific to a crop type. And that is something that we want to work with Purdue.
So you're going to have specific lights for specific – that's just amazing. We're a long way from the shop light and the fluorescent tube and growing your seedlings underneath that.
And we're also working with Dr. Giacomelli on organic fertilizers using organic food waste that we can process to make sure it's clean and pathogen-free, that it would be used to use as a fertilizer to enhance our production.
So – what's interesting about this is the idea that you are doing this organically because it's so high tech, and you don't think of organics and high tech coming together like that. Are you going to be at some point certified organic? Are you already?
Our challenge right now is everything we do is organic except our fertilizer. Most people doing hydroponic or a thin film technology are using either fish waste or fish byproducts or ground up plants. And with our system,
like they are at the plant on the south side, the aquaponics,
yes,
businesses
and farmed here. That's problematic in our view. That potentially can cause a lot of bacteria. It's a hard system to maintain. You're dealing with two biologies. You know,
you've got lots of variables there, don't
living,
you?
Living exactly, yeah. And you don't get the intense nutrients that you get out of traditional fertilizer. So we're working on that right now. One of the things we use is coconut coir. It's ground coconut.
C-O-I-R.
Yes.
And nobody knows how to pronounce it. It's a choir,
what? Yeah, I've heard it pronounced many different ways.
Yeah,
but it's a renewable resource. It comes from the coconuts, and it does not act as a soil. It just provides a medium in which the roots can grow, and then our nutrients pass through that. So putting organic into a system where there's not carbon creates complex problems and challenges. But I also look at those as opportunities because we're going to figure a way to come up with a proprietary fertilizer that's going to cause our system to grow. This is a very complex system that deals with CO2, lights, water, nutrient, temperature, humidity. And that's where we control all those factors.
Yeah, it's amazing. I went and saw the operation and you were telling me there about controlling the amount of CO2 in the air. It's like unbelievable stuff you
because
could never do outside.
We produce an oxygen-rich environment. Plants need CO2. That's why they're good for global warming and climate change. They sequester the carbon. And in an environment where CO2 is not pumped in, it becomes very oxygen rich and the plants can't grow properly. So we pump in CO2, they produce oxygen. So it's a great, great carbon sequestration facility. And I dropped you off two obscure herbs.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned these. Yes.
You know, one is a chervil. It's a French parsley. It has a really delicate, light licorice taste. It's good for seasoning and flavoring mild dishes like seafood, poultry, soups, sauces, even vegetable dishes like fresh carrots. And the other one is a mouth-watering dill. It's great with seafood. And what comes to my mind is sour cream and salmon. Herbs can also be used for medicinal uses. And that dill is good for easing gas in your stomach, bloating, and settling stomach issues. So these herbs have both...
Dr. Colangelo well, gives you advice.
What I like is that we make people happy. People like to see us. They like to eat fresh vegetables. We produce all those vegetables that your mother told you to eat. And I have to give a shout-out to my grandmother and my mother. Both my grandmother was an excellent cook, and so is my mother. And they taught us at a young age that if you want to make a great dish, it starts with fresh ingredients. And so that's what we love to do at Green Sense Farms. You know, grow fresh ingredients that are good for you. They're nutritious. They're delicious. And they make people happy.
This is great. And you've got your own little package here. And you've got, although it says chives on it, I don't know.
Yeah, we didn't have the chervil. I didn't get the chervil bag, so I tossed that in there.
The chives bag. But it says locally grown, pesticide-free, preservative-free, GMO-free. It's a live plant. I can plant this.
And you know what's the best thing about that? It's made in America. People complain we don't make enough here in America. That's made in America every day, 365 days a year. And you could find those at Whole Foods.
That's amazing. Yeah, look for green. Now, do you have, does it say Green? Well, it says Portage, Indiana.
On the back of the label.
There we are, Green Sense Farms. There's your logo. So look for Green Sense Farms at Whole Foods. And where else might they find it?
Streck and Van Til, and we're just working on a number of other stores, and we'll talk maybe in the future, and you'll see us.
We will. You are going to be back here. Well, stick around, because we've got Kate Sackman coming in, and you've interviewed her, and...
Yes, we had her, the Eco Mythbusters. I think what she's doing is fantastic. She's been on the show. But, Mike, again, I just want to thank you and your staff here for having us on. Keeping the word out there on the environment and sustainability is very important. We can't get complacent. It seems like people don't pay attention until there's an ecological disaster. So our job's to keep the issue on people's mind all the time. So good luck and good jobs.
You too. You know, and you're not only talking the talk, you're walking the walk.
It's a love fest in here.
It is.
And this is why I have hope. This is why Guy McPherson's wrong. There's people like this out there.
Well, and I see the world as, look at all the good we've been doing. You can look at the bad, but I look at technology, innovation, and creativity is our solution. And America's a resilient country. We're going to do it.
That's my hope.